What is biopolitics? I feel I should begin by trying to introduce the meaning of this term, biopolitics, and by wondering on which specific uses and connotations may be interesting for our work. This is a quite difficult task, because the word and the concept of biopolitics has assumed so many different, sometimes opposite meanings, and gave birth to such plural and conflictual interpretations and theoretical elaborations from the beginning of the 20th century until very recent years, that I cannot even try to resume them here. I will give you only some brief inputs that could help us to focus on the interest that biopolitics may have in the postcolonial field we are working on. I will also introduce the specificity of the Caribbean post-slavery context and show how, according to me, the textual analysis of Edouard Glissant's work could help to develop what I could call an affirmative biopolitics. Over recent years, the concept of biopolitics has revealed itself to be a particularly effective and fertile space of critical thought on our present. First of all, I would stress that it is not, strictly speaking, a concept, but something wider and less definable, that I would call, using Foucault's formula, a discursive field, like bioethics, for instance. It functions as a sort of battlefield where very different theories and positions meet and fight together. Even if this term is largely attested before Foucault and developed in many other different directions, the actual philosophical debate around biopolitics has been mainly generated and influenced by Foucault's later works and seminars, where he developed his previous reflections on the relationship of co-implication between power, knowledge, the subject, and life. We could start by quoting the definition he gives in a fundamental and well-known chapter of The Will to Knowledge, the first volume of The History of Sexuality of 1976, where he affirms that biopower brought life and its mechanisms into the realm of explicit calculations and made knowledge power an agent of the transformation of human life. Modern man is an animal whose politics places his existence as a living being in question. End of quote. What Foucault tries to point out with the phrase biopolitical threshold is a shift in the art of government and sovereignty that happened in Europe during the 18th century. It saw the increasing development of strategies and devices of government which focused on the objectification and normalization of the bodies and populations, what Foucault calls the disciplinary technologies, like prisons, hospitals, schools, etc., whose aim was to forge a, quote, docile body that may be subjected, used, transformed, and improved, end of quote, by discipline and punishment. The reciprocal and substantial involvement of life and power in contemporary neoliberal society made itself increasingly evident. Today, as the Italian philosopher Laura Bazzicalupo has commented, quote, the bodies of those who have power and the bodies of those who are subjected to power become central, end of quote. This can show all the ambivalence of biopolitics, meaning power's life-controlling grip and the shifting of this biopower toward a destructive practice concerning life itself. As both Giorgio Agamben and Roberto Esposito have stressed, the 20th century, in particular with the concentration camps and Nazis' development of eugenics, has realized in the most brutal and definitive way this reversal from a politics of life or over life to a politics of death, from a biopolitics to a thanatopolitics. At the present time, this dynamic seems to involve the most important political phenomena of our era at a planetary level. As Roberto Esposito writes in his very important book Bios of 2004, quote, the body that experiences even more intensely the indistinction between power and life is no longer that of the individual, nor it is that sovereign body of nations, but that body of the world that is both torn and unified. From the war of and against terrorism to mass migrations, from the politics of public health to those of demography, from measures of security to the unlimited extensions of emergency legislation, there is no phenomenon of international importance that is extraneous to the double tendency that situates the episodes I have just described within a single line of meaning. On the one hand, a growing superimposition between the domain of power or of law and that of life. On the other, an equally close implication that seems to have been derived with regard to death. Why, continues Esposito, does a politics of life always risk being reversed into a work of death? End of quote. To sum up, we are dealing with a radical turn with respect to the classical and Aristotelian concept of politics, which presupposed a clear separation between private space, oikos, and public space, polis, and between the natural life, zoe, and political qualified life, or bios. These distinctions diminish when the body of the biological life of man, individual and population, not only become passive objects addressed by power through norms, prohibitions, restrictions, disciplines, etc., but the product of a positive action of power itself, in terms of defense, growth, and the enhancement of life. Indeed, according to Foucault's vision, power actively exercises its effects on the processes of subjectification through the connection between knowledge and practices. Hence, the reciprocal involvement of truth and power plays itself out entirely on bodies, which are the repositories of power while also being modeled by it. Thus, not only does the omnipervasive character of biopower show itself, but also the possible forms of resistance and escape from it. The entire theoretical debate of recent years has its center of gravity in this structural ambivalence, what Esposito calls the enigma of biopolitics, between power over life and power of life. Quote, biopower, which subdues life to subjugate and govern it, and biopolitics understood in an affirmative sense, such as productivity of life itself, potency of life to resist or subtract or to confirm its own desires and its own abilities. The drowning human body. After this very brief and incomplete introduction to biopolitics, I would like to propose to you a couple of more concrete examples showing the centrality of these issues for the Caribbean historical and cultural context during and after colonization and slavery. This historical specificity may begin to explain why and how contemporary artistic and literary production in the Caribbean could help to deconstruct the biopolitical devices in which we are captured and to produce new forms of thinking, language and imagination from which, to quote Esposito again, is it possible to sketch the first features of a biopolitics that is finally affirmative, not one over life, but of life. The Caribbean involvement in modern biopolitics and thanatopolitics is extremely evident and significant, and I would stress this is a very foundational element of global modernity. Colonial domination, deportation, slavery, and the Middle Passage are not only a founding step in the genealogy of Western capitalist modes of production, as it has been analyzed by many scholars starting from Eric Williams' Capitalism and Slavery of 1944. Through the massive development of slavery and the plantation system, modern biopolitics has developed and carried out some of its cruelest and most effective devices of capture, government, discipline, subjugation, and negation of the living. In a certain sense, it can be stated that slavery and colonial domination, with their practices of dominion and subjugation of bodies, and also with their legal formalization and their racist social and ideological structures, have constituted a veritable laboratory of biocracy in the modernity. To explain this concept in a more concrete way, I would like to suggest that the paradigmatic figure of the Caribbean biopolitics is the drowning human body, the enslaved body thrown into the sea from the slave ship during the transatlantic passage. I'm also inspired here by Jan Bokum's article on the transatlantic slave trade and its memories, Spectres of the Atlantic, of 2001. The figure of the drowning human body, in its absolute and sublime tragedy, is perhaps the ultimate limit in the objectification and commodification of the living body. Here, the human life is reduced by the legal, economic and ideological devices that compose the Black Atlantic Triangle to an absolutely killable bare life, to use Agamben's well-known concept developed in his work Homo Sacer. This device that worked capturing and marketing human beings on the coasts of Africa, transforming them into chattels to be sold on the slave markets, is the real foundation of the colonial plantation economy system and its legacy of racism and segregation. William Turner's very famous painting, The Slave Ship of 1840, originally titled Slavers Throwing Overboard the Dead and the Dying, Typhoon Coming On, gives us the pretext to link this main biopolitical paradigm to a specific historical and famous event, the Zong Massacre, which inspired Turner's painting. In 1781, 132 slaves were jettisoned and murdered by the captain of the Zong slave ship, Luke Collingwood, because he became aware that his supplies of water and food were running out, and that the six slaves would have threatened the welfare of the rest of the human merchandise. Moreover, and this is the real biopolitical aspect, he intended to claim compensation for these jettison goods under the salvage clause of the Zong's marine insurance policy. The trial that followed the events saw him acquitted. The operating laws of property had conferred on each of the slave bodies a measurable and recoverable quantity of value, concretely reducing their life to exchange value. This is both a perfect and tragic example of the kind of thanatopolitical device which I am attempting to draw attention to in its specific colonial and proto-capitalist development. In 2008, the Canadian poet, born in Trinidad and Tobago, Nurbezi Philip, published a really astonishing poem entitled Zong, which represents for me a perfect example of how the poetic work can deal with the abyss of silence and lack which the relentless and mute universe of slavery, to quote Glisson, sings, and with the absence and the impossibility of testimony. It's a very disturbing poetic experience, as you can already see at first glance just looking at the graphical relation between the words, syllables, or even onomatopoeic sounds and the white of the page. If we'll have some more time at the end of my presentation, I would like to show you a couple of minutes of her reading this poem. Another concrete example could be taken from the legislation regulating the French Atlantic Triangle, Le Code Noir, drafted by Colbert and promulgated by Louis XIV in 1685. This document could be read in its entirety as a perfect example of what biopolitics means. The body is captured and reduced to bare life through this legal device, interweaving and overlapping religious discourse, the instrumental and economic care of the slave's body, the most brutal physical punishment, and, above all, his total commodification, as stated in the infamous Article 44, déclarant les esclaves être meubles et comptent-ils entrer dans la communauté. We are still very far here, of course, from the modern biopolitical discourse analyzed by Foucault within the framework of neoliberal governmentality. However, In the plantation system, we can already identify some of the most specific issues and ambivalences of the biopolitical droit de mort et pouvoir sur la vie, to quote Foucault, the pervasive and intimate control and surveillance of the body. In Le Code Noir, slaves are personal property, chattels, but paradoxically, at the same time, they do have a soul, in a Christian sense, an infantilized soul conceived to better imprison and enslave their bodies. We could also add that the spatial structure of the plantation itself worked as a sort of reversed panopticon, which I remind you is for Foucault of Discipline and Punishment, the paradigm of the disciplinary technology. The master's house, in fact, was always situated in the center of the plantation and up on an elevated position, so that all the slaves could see it in any time of day and night. This structure favored a complete internalization by the slave of the devices of control and subjugation, suffocating every impulse of escape or rebellion. Glissant and biopolitics. Let's move on now to the literary work of Edouard Glissant and how it deals with biopolitics. This will need quite a long and deep analysis of his work, but as this is not a seminar for Glissant's specialists, I'll just give you some main sketches that, I hope, might be useful in a wider perspective too. In spring 2010, I had the chance to attend one of his last conferences in Paris before he died. It was held at the Maison de l'Amérique Latine, where the annual seminars of the Institut du Tout Monde usually take place. On that occasion, Glissant presented a paper entitled Rien n'est vrai, tout est vivant, Nothing is true, everything is living, which he defined as a still obscure and quite difficult text, which he had reflected on for a long time and which he had been written in a burst of dazzling inspiration. The author himself had suggested that the phrase Rien n'est vrai, tout est vivant should be used as the theme for the annual seminar cycle of the Institut du Tout Monde. We also find it placed as the epigraph to the Tout Monde poetry anthology La Terre, le Feu, l'Eau et le Vent of 2010, the last work published during his lifetime. At the beginning, this sentence shocked me quite a lot, even if Glissant's readers are used to this sort of messianic posture and the tone he often assumed in his later works. But the main doubt didn't concern the sense of this statement, but the form of the enunciation. Was it a sort of paradoxical dogma, seemingly so radical and definitive, but at the same time negating itself? Or was it a motto or an admonition? Last spring, during a conference in Atlanta, I had the chance to meet Valérie Loiseau, one of the main scholars working of the Martinican author, who presented a paper on Glissant's graves. Thanks to her, I discovered that Glissant decided to inscribe this sentence as an epitaph on his grave in Martinique, realized by the ceramist and painter Victor Anissé. In her paper, Valérie suggested to read the sentence as a riddle or an enigma, connected with a long tradition going back to both the pre-Socratic philosophy of Heraclitus and the African and Caribbean storyteller. In short, it wasn't a statement, but a sentence to question and to be questioned by. As it's evident, this opaque form of thinking and expression points in a completely different direction than the Western epistemic drive and will to knowledge. In Glissant's introduction to the anthology of the poetry of the Tout Monde, we find his inspired poetic sentence, which in a sense seems to sum up the essence of his poetic and philosophical quest in his final years. Ah, la connaissance est là, si loin, mais qu'importe, voici que tout est vivant, dans toutes les directions et sur les hauts plateaux. This quotation immediately reminded me of another phrase I had read in Michel Foucault's final article La vie, l'expérience et la science of 1985, where he tried to define a new epistemological perspective in which human life is not exclusively connected to the discourse and the regions of truth, but with its inherent dimension of error and errancy. The stunning affinity with the Glissantian thinking about the living initially suggested to me that there was a possible link between the Martinican poet and biopolitics. To quote Foucault, à la limite, la vie, c'est ce qui est capable d'erreur. La vie aboutit avec l'homme à un vivant qui ne se trouve jamais tout à fait à sa place, à un vivant qui est voué à errer et à se tromper. Glissant's paper Nothing is True, Everything is Living was intended to be part of a larger work in progress, a great poem, as he defined it, presumably hanging on the relationship between the true and the living. The reflection on life and living, particularly in their often conflictual relationship with truth, with historic sense, with consciousness and the discourse of knowledge, assumed increasing importance in his later works. However, this theme runs through his entire oeuvre, since his first works, Soleil de la Conscience of 1957-56 and L'Intention Poétique of 1969. And at a deeper level, ceaselessly structures and destructures his entire language. This openness toward the living in the last phase of Glissant's work touches a veritable point of vertigo and produces a double movement that is both hermeneutic and theoretical. This double perspective allows us to reinterpret some significant moments of his work through an analytic device centered on the relationship between life and form, or rather, between origin and history. What is really interesting in my perspective is that the poetic productivity of this intersection and entanglement between the opaque immanence of the living and the act of writing, considered not only in his representative or mimetic function, but as a way of actively inhabiting and generating the place and the world. When I attended Glissant's conference in Paris, my research interests drove me to study the contemporary debate around the concept of biopolitics. I was wondering why an issue like slavery and its postcolonial legacies, which is clearly and strongly linked with the biopolitical genealogy of global modernity, was completely absent in the theoretical works of such scholars as Agamben and Esposito. I was wondering how the issues of biopolitics in both its negative and affirmative aspect could be linked with the analysis of Caribbean literature. What new hermeneutic perspective could this link open up, and why, again, were slavery and colonialism remarkable for their absence, for being a hole and an erasure within most political philosophy? Glissant's paper, Nothing is True, Everything is Living, revealed to me some very interesting points to bring about a connection between his writing and biopolitics, and to reconsider his entire work in the light of the complex, non-linear intersection between the living, biopower, and poetic language. Even closer to Glissant is Gilles Deleuze's reflection in his last published article, Immanence, Alive, of 1995, and this is no coincidence that Glissant's, Foucault's, and Deleuze's last articles and conferences were about this conflictual relation between truth and the living. In this fascinating text, the French philosopher develops his concept of the living as a pure plane of immanence, explaining that this nascent philosophy must explore a vertigo of thought which has neither consciousness nor subject. Similarly to Glissant's concept of living, the pure plane of immanence acts as a flux preceding every form of conscious transcendence and every dialectic process of subjectification and objectification. Quote, absolute immanence is in itself, it is not in something, to something. It does not depend on an object or belong to a subject. End of quote, by Gilles Deleuze. Immanence, confirms Deleuze along with Guattari, quote, is immanent only to itself and consequently captures everything, absorbs all one, and leaves nothing remaining to which it could be immanent. End of quote. The tendency of more recent biopolitical philosophy to privilege the impersonal only partially approaches Glissant's poetics of relation. However, it is apparent how much this concept of a pure plane of immanence influenced Glissant's thoughts on relation and creolization, as he progressively distanced his ideas away from the initial phenomenological formation still evident in his early text. In his introduction to the Anthologie du Tout Monde, which explores the relation and its connection with the becoming totality of the living, Glissant's proximity to the Deleuzian plane of immanence is evident. The Tout Monde is total insofar as we all dream of it thus, and its difference from the totality is that its whole is a process of becoming. The totality of the Tout Monde is thus the realized quantity of all the world's differences, without the omission of even the least certain of them. Glissant's reversal of colonial thanatopolitics, the open boat. I would like to conclude this paper giving some suggestions about how this reversal of the colonial thanatopolitics into an affirmative biopolitics is worked through in Glissantian poetics of relation. His great concern with the issue of the body and with the productive mutual influence between the writing of the body and the body of writing has been signaled and analyzed by many critics. The paradigmatic and tragic figure of the drowning human body is central to his work. It recurs so many times like a sort of an uncanny and unspeakable haunting element existing inside the discourse like a hole or void and troubling every realistic staging of characters and the linearity of the prose. The tragic confrontation between writing and the unspeakable is, in my opinion, one of the most interesting aspects of Glissant's poetry and philosophy. A cry suddenly comes out from the mute and opaque abyss of the suffering body, l'immigrant nu, as he defines him in Les Discours Antillais of 1981, breaking every discourse of absolute truth and every humanistic attempt to separate the discourse from the body. Only by moving across this painful and opaque abyss, thanks to the act of writing and poetic imagination, is Glissant able to contribute to the poetic and political productivity of an affirmative biopolitics. This dramatic reversal of colonial thanatopolitics into a new affirmative and relational perspective for a global community to come is evident in the inspired poetic chapter opening Poetics of Relation of 1990. In a powerful allegoric displacement, the opacity and muteness of the abyss of suffering is reversed into a new form of shared knowledge. It's worth quoting a long excerpt. Quote, "For, in your poetic vision, a boat has no belly. A boat does not swallow up, does not devour. A boat is steered by open skies. Yet the belly of this boat dissolves you, precipitates you into a known world from which you cry out. This boat is a womb abyss. It generates the clamor of your protests. It also produces all the coming unanimity. Although you are alone in this suffering, you share in the unknown with others whom you have yet to know." End of quote. The deadly belly of the slave ship is reversed into the open boat that symbolizes a new form of knowledge oriented toward the errancy of the living. Quote again by Glissant. Thus, the absolute unknown, projected by the abyss and buried into eternity the womb abyss and the infinite abyss, in the end became knowledge. Not just a specific knowledge, appetite, suffering and delight of one particular people, not only that, but knowledge of the world, greater from having been at the abyss and free knowledge of relation within the world. End of quote. This very beautiful passage gives us a very clear idea of what a biopolitical reading of Glissant could imply. His poetic and philosophical reflection of a politics that is no longer over life but of life, to quote Esposito again, may also be read as a patient and steady manoeuvre to overturn colonial and postcolonial thanatopolitics. Reading Glissant from such a perspective means, first and foremost, taking into consideration the inherent relationship between poetry and thought, which runs through his entire work and finds one of its deepest motivations in the necessary entanglement of poetic language and the living. Indeed, this confrontation with the tragic and unspeakable dimension of time and place affects not only his theoretical thinking, but on a deeper level his language and writing. This new articulation of bodies into the two mondes allows us to imagine and practice an affirmative planetary biopolitics. I think that Glissant's concept of the two mondes is very close to what Jean-Luc Nancy in Corpus of 2000 has called Mundus Corpus, le monde con le peuplement proliférant des lieux du corps. The world becomes the world of the bodies, of their irreducible difference, singularity, extension, and relation. Undocile bodies that break any attempt for a transcendental order or discipline. For both Glissant and Nancy, the world is no more something to be conquered or governed through different kinds of civilizing missions, but a plurality of places inhabited and lived in a reciprocal, however difficult, openness and constituent relationship. Thank you very much.